The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
As a private investor, my insurance policy is gold. I favor stocks over bullion, but that's just me. So I try and find values there. And if I'm right about gold taking preeminence at some point, when we have this Dow to gold ratio of 5-1, these gold stocks are going to do quite well. So that's where I'm at. I have to have that insurance policy.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We have a returning guest, Alan Newman. And, you know, as we think about the guests that we have on the program, a lot of them are in their 70s. Some are in their 80s. And there's a reason for that. Guys like Alan Newman, Richard Russell, Jim Deeds, Alan Abelson, Ian McCavity, these are guys who can bring 50 years of experience to the table. Why wouldn't we talk to them?
Well, that's exactly right. You learn a lot in a short period of time within the financial markets. And when you begin to aggregate that through decades, it creates a certain perspective and a certain wisdom that only comes with age. So You may know quite a bit in your 20s and 30s and 40s, but knowing what it all means and how it all fits together, I don't think that's plain and obvious until you're a little bit more mature.
Well, and I think of people like your dad, okay? You know, he's pushing 79 this year. He's going to turn 79. He's as young in his mind as I've ever known him. He continues the need to share his knowledge and his experience. Alan Newman's the same way. You know, he keeps trying to retire because the work that he does, a lot of it is chart-oriented. It's very, very labor-intensive. And every time he tries to retire, people beg him not to do it. And he says, if I'm continuing at all, it's just for the love of it.
That's right. With decades of experience in the market, you begin to see some interesting parallels between men who've been there and done that, and women who've made these same sorts of observations. And I think the correlations between perspectives can be very helpful at times. I remember Richard Russell. This is back in the year 2000, 2001, 2002. As I was working at Morgan Stanley, I was reading Richard Russell every day.
And he had written that letter since the 50s, long before you were born.
That's right. He became popular in the days of Alan Abelson and really got his start in the newsletter business through writing a column in Barron's. And Russell took the Dow theory concepts, and I remember being fascinated by it. Having neglected gold for a long period of time as I was studying philosophy and didn't really have an interest in what our family business had been, here's a guy who's talking about the Dow and gold and the relationship and how he expected to see it go from what at the time was in the 40s down to a 5-1 or a 3-1 or even a 1-1 relationship. And that got my attention while I was at Morgan Stanley, and actually was a part of the move back into the metals business with our family business and ultimately the asset management business, where these things do stand in very significant long-term relationships. Again, whether it's Richard Russell or Ian McCavity or Alan Newman, there's an echo from one to the other in terms of the analysis and the insight, but a lot of it is instinct that to some degree comes out of the trenches, being in the markets every day for all those decades.
You know, one characteristic that they share too is they have outlived the value of the dollar. In their lifetimes, the dollar has lost over 95% of its value. And each one, I mean, Richard Russell, Alan Newman, these are guys who say, look, stop measuring things in dollars. Start looking at how much an ounce of gold is worth in Dow shares, or what we talk about, how much platinum is worth in palladium, and how much silver is worth in gold. Things that don't go away, where you're measuring value for value, not something that just disappears into thin air.
Alan, it's great to have you on the program. You've got Cross Currents, which is your writing expression. It's been there for 30 plus years. And as Cross Currents is winding down, we hope to keep in touch with you and make sure that Florida is treating you well. Thanks for joining us on the commentary again.
Thank you for inviting me on, David. It's always a pleasure.
You know, some things in the market change through the passing of time, and some are constant. We can reflect on the shortness of investor or creditor memory, or the quick return of greed to the marketplace. Psychology of the participants seems to be one of those constants. But what about when investors just start to take their marbles and go home, no longer wanting to play the game? we've got this weird indicator that would say actually there's increased activity in the markets, and yet we know that household investors are somewhat absent. So you've got total dollar trading in the market, which is again on the increase, not necessarily an indication of household investor interest. Talk to us about what these changing dynamics are.
Yeah, well, small investors have been pulling out ever since the NASDAQ crash back from the tech mania. Too many people got badly hurt. And then you have the same thing happen in from 2007 to 2009. So the public, if it's participating at this point, is just tossing the money towards professionals and letting them try and run with it. But that has not really worked. This market is increasingly ruled by program traders, by algorithmic traders, people who put together formulas to trade with. And when you have such a period as this, where dollar trading volume is multiples, many multiples of what it was years ago, you're looking at an arena where only the short term counts for professionals. And what this does is it just completely cuts values. They don't matter anymore. I come from the school of Graham and Dodd. I started investing in 1964. That's like medieval times, where people looked at the price-earnings ratio of a stock. They looked ahead. They looked at all the fundamentals that are seemingly ignored today. And there's so much that is based on leverage today that it can't be safe. We've had this just enormous increase in margin debt. Again, this is multiples of what has been in the past. And this denotes danger. The more leverage you have in a market, the more risk you have. And we saw a little piece of that risk early in the year when we had that decline. But it's still not a bear market, and I think we're going to get to that pretty soon.
Alan, an increase in dollars trading in the market, regardless of the source, you know, maybe it is the professional investor, the algorithm trading, the high-frequency trading models at work, but regardless of the source, what does it suggest to you in terms of where we're at in the cycle? You see this increase in volumes. What does that tell you in terms of growth and expansion? Are we early in the cycle? Are we late in the cycle? Where are we at?
Well, it's the same in any bull market. You typically see volume expand into a final peak. And I think we had that. Although actually, for the month of January, dollar trading volume is up even another 1.3%. But again, this is just the professionals. This is just the people who are putting together these algorithms to trade with. And they're just avoiding any concept of value. And if you're in a market where value is meaningless, then it could fall apart at any time. I'm not sure if this exactly answers your question, but that's what I'm seeing here.
Yeah, so value becomes an interesting concept, and maybe just a theoretical one, in a period of financial history like this. And is the unique aspect of this particular period in financial history the degree to which central banks have involved themselves in the pricing of assets?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this started with Alan Greenspan. He had a chance in 1996. I believe the date was December 3rd, where he pondered about irrational values. And he did that correctly, but he didn't do anything about it. And by late 1998, that mania really began to take hold. In retrospect, looking back from me, who's observed these markets for, this is the 55th year I've been around, NASDAQ was trading over 250 times earnings. The entire NASDAQ was trading over 250 times earnings. I've never seen anything like that. I don't think I will ever see anything like that again. I don't think you will. I don't think your children will. That's how phenomenal that was. And then we followed that mania by another one that really got started because of housing and very, very easy credit. You know, 10% down for a house that you couldn't afford in the first place. So you were buying three or four of them just to try and make some money. And that was going to fall apart. And it took stocks with it because stocks went a little crazy into the fall of 2007. And now, this time around, we're talking within a generation, in the year 2000 and 2000, let's say 2008 and 2018, another mania. I mean, I can show you that this is a mania in so many different ways. For one, Shiller's cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, it's known as CAPE, that's the acronym. It's basically a 10-year moving average of earnings. That is at the second highest reading in history. It's higher than it was in 1929. This all ends poorly.
Well, so I mean, looking back in time, you know, you referenced the 1920s. Can you recall another period in financial history where you've had three manias clustered together in a single generation?
No, not at all. We've had two fairly close apart, but they were in different continents back in the 19th century. We've had some ludicrous arenas in the past, but what we're seeing over the last generation, I think it's an avoidance of fiduciary responsibility. Mutual fund portfolio managers have taken equity funds down to 2.9% cash to assets ratio. Again, the lowest in history. It's been as high as 14% in the past. So what happens when you get down to 2.9%? Well, if you have an opportunity, you almost can't take advantage of it because you don't have the flexibility anymore. A lot of that is because ETFs have become such a smash hit because ETFs are fully invested by definition. They have to be. So typical equity mutual fund to compete, it's got to be more or less fully invested. But in the long run, that hurts. That doesn't help.
Talked about valuation. I want to come back to that a minute because one of the things that is a part of the structure of the markets today is we're talking about dollar volume, the amount of shares traded, and the dollar amount on a daily basis. We also have a tremendous amount of leverage in the system. Margin debt as a percentage of GDP, that's one aspect of leverage in the system, but we also have products. Going back to the ETF comments you're making, these are structured to capture two or three or four times the increase
right.
of an asset class. So that, I mean, leverage, again, we think of sort of outsized bets and overconfidence being expressed and beginning to use the house's money on a theme that you're confident with. Tell us a little bit about margin debt, where it is and what that indicates to you.
Well, at one point last year, we were up to margin debt equaling over 3.5% of GDP. And the only time that ever happened before was in 1929. It was actually worse in 1929. But, you know, you could buy stocks 10% on the dollar. Now, Reg T from the SEC has it at 50 cents on the dollar. If you have $1,000, you can buy $2,000 worth of stock. Back in 1929, if you had $1,000, you could buy $10,000 worth of stock. So then if a stock went down 10%, you wiped out. Nowadays, if the stock goes down 50%, you wiped out. Not that these things are actually going to happen, but it just tells you how much risk is in the marketplace. And I made the case back in the tech mania where people were taking credit card loans and home equity lines or whatever money they could borrow from their bank and buying stocks with it. I mean, it seemed to be a sure bet. NASDAQ was absolutely going to the moon. And when you're in a situation like that, and I think it's happening again today, not maybe to the same extent, there's more leverage in the system than you really know, than you can imagine.
So, you know, the Dow gold ratio is an interesting way of looking at where, again, just kind of from a valuation standpoint, and this captures relative valuation, kind of the generational champion of Dow theory was the late Richard Russell. 20 years ago, nearly 20 years ago, when the Dow gold ratio was 43-1, Richard Russell was discussing a move to 5-1, 3-1, even the potential, at least historically, looking at how it had gotten to 1-1 on the ratio. So what we're talking about is the relative pricing of gold to financial assets. The ratio is like shorthand for what people feel and how they feel about owning physical tangible assets vis-a-vis the financial assets. And this kind of takes us back to market psychology, reflecting itself in the price action of these two distinct asset classes. What's your target, and what are your thoughts on gold as one part of the equation, the Dow as the other contributor to the ratio? What's your target? How do we get there?
The target ratio that I established, believe it or not, on 9/11, after that attack, I sat down and I said, there's something wrong here. There has been a monumental change in our future. And the numbers I came up with are favorites of other people, 5-1. But I got that as high as 5.67-1. Don't ask me why I narrowed it down that much, but I think that's the upper limit. We could go from somewhere between 5-1 or 5.67-1. I would be satisfied that my Super Bowl gold market target had been achieved. But this depends upon the Dow. I mean, if the Dow is at 15,000, but the gold is $3,000 an ounce, I'm actually comfortable with that. But just for the sake of argument, let's say the Dow is at 30,000, which will happen someday. I don't know how many years out. It could be 50 years out. I don't know. And at some point, the Dow will be 30,000. That's the number I took. 5-to-1 has gold at 6,000. Right now, at this point in time, I'm not comfortable with gold that high. I don't see why it would be that high. But for the target levels that I have, it would take gold between 2646 per ounce to 3,000 per ounce. I'm very happy with that prognostication. I'm not exactly sure when it's going to happen because a lot of it is going to have to do with the Dow. If we, just for the sake of argument, we have a crash, gold can go up, but I don't know if it's going to go up enough for us to see that 5-to-1 target then. We might see it a few years later.
So again, it captures not only the potential devaluation or decline of one asset price, but also the increase of the other asset. If you do see an increase in the price of gold, mining companies have got to have a play. In your opinion, is this the environment we have today? Is it something like 2015, 2016? Or as you look at gold mining companies, is this more akin from a valuation perspective to 2002, 2003 relative to gold?
I think this dates back to after the terror attacks when we all realized that there should be some type of flight to safety, you know, gold equating to safety. I've done a study on Islamist terror attacks. Maybe I unfairly just limited to Islamists, but it works for me. And we had a huge bulge in the five-year average. And I'm talking way after 9/11. We had a huge bulge in the number of incidents and the number of people killed. And then it calmed down again, and then it's gone up again. Just for the sake of argument, back in 2000, the five-year average of the number of Islamist terror attacks was under 5. Last year, it was above 53. That's a five-year average. I think the world changed on 9/11. I don't think we're anywhere near out of the woods. I think this is going to be a problem for a generation to come. So that's basically why I got involved with gold. And one of the reasons why I'm still so bullish on the market is I see many juniors at the best valuations I've seen in years.
Well, so talk to us about gold as an asset class with a global audience. We price things here in U.S. dollar terms, but you're talking about something that prices for everyone else in their domestic currency, foreign currencies to us, not U.S. dollars, and could look different. What's the global perspective on gold?
I think it's fine. We've had a long consolidation here, and of course, as you said, we tend to see things just priced in dollars. But if you look at bullion priced in yen, it's only a few percentage points from an all-time high. That's astonishing. I mean, we're looking at gold well above 1,300, and we remember 1,800 a few years ago. So it seems so far away. If you own gold priced in yen, you're just there. You're knocking on the door of a brand new all-time high. And I think we all have to take a worldview now. It's not assets just based on the U.S. dollar. We can buy assets based in yen or pounds or euros.
And for a global audience that is concerned with flight to safety, they are making the translation, aren't they, from their currency?
Oh, I believe so, yes.
And it seems to be a growing trend of central bankers to focus on inflation as a solution for very large stocks of debt. And it's politically palatable because most of your constituents don't understand that that's how you relieve the pressure of an over-leveraged system, private corporate governmental debt.
Exactly.
So it seems like, you know, between terror attacks and destabilization events like that and monetary policy, which is aggressively geared towards inflating away the burden of debt, that for someone who's thinking, what do I do with my savings? It's not irrational. It's not irrational to think that, yeah, a modest percentage could be allocated to gold and be effective there.
Well, I've had money in real estate for my entire adult life, and I've always loved real estate. It's always going to be there. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's always going to be there. It's something that's quite tangible. It's actually more tangible than gold. I mean, holding on to physical gold presents some problems. It doesn't make you any money. It's just an investment. It's also an insurance policy. So in terms of alternative investments, there's always a stock out there to buy. I'll give you an illustration. I'm not going to mention the name of the stock unless you want me to, but I bought my first cannabis stock recently. It's a company. The revenues are growing tremendously. I can see where this is going. I see a lot of research being done. I see medical centers sprouting up all over the place. My wife and I wandered into Staples a couple of days ago. We needed something for the office. And right next to it is a medical marijuana store. I noticed that there was something there, but I didn't know what it was. It was medical marijuana. So there's always something there. Is it going to be the next Microsoft or the next Apple? I don't know, but it's something brand new. It's something that works. And investments like that will always be around, even in a bear market. But again, my favorite would be real estate.
So between real estate and, you know, other tangibles, there are still some places to go. You know, the context that we're in has been somewhat skewed, as we said earlier, by central bank activity in the marketplace. You get the Japanese, who began their process of experimenting with low interest rates 20 years ago. 20 years ago this week.
Mm-hmm.
And once you go down that road, it doesn't appear that there's any coming back, because you've got the pain of repricing assets. Again, just to reflect the realistic cost of capital, that pain seems to be too great. What's your bet? What's your play? Can the central bank community hold at bay the consequences of low interest rates? Is this what we have on a global basis, them trying to toy with asset prices, keep them elevated, manipulating monetary policy, using monetary policy as a manipulative tool for asset prices? Or what's the case that you can make for there actually being a bear market in assets where the central bank doesn't control the outcomes?
Well, you mentioned Japan. They have a specific problem that not many people want to discuss. They are an aging population. The average age in Japan, I think, is about 47 or 47 and change. And their economy is suffering because there's too many old people. Younger people buy more stuff. It's as simple as that. So in Japan, they have no option. They have to try and boost asset prices as much as possible. I don't think central banks can do this in the very long run. They've already done it in the long run. But at some point, I think they fail. We were just talking about real estate and gold, and I was saying I still love real estate. However, gold is the safer option because it's an insurance policy against whatever happens down the road. Whichever way we go, it's the currency of last resort. As for our central bank, I think we're going to be as ineffective as Japan at some point, but that's still years down the road. I don't think central banks can run the world's economies and fine-tune them. We've seen problems with this approach in the past. I think we'll see problems with this approach in the future. It's kind of working right now. For us in the U.S., inflation is kind of tame. And so far, we're able to sustain debt of $21 trillion. But that's going to turn, and when it does, oh boy, I don't want to see the fallout.
We had a conversation with William White a couple of years ago, who spends time in Basel, Switzerland with the Bank of International Settlements and kind of moonlights with the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. And he made this very simple case that the central bank community is given credit for being sort of scientists and engineers for the global economy, when in fact they're artists and get things as wrong as they do right. But for whatever reason, they have a pretty significant credibility benefit. Maybe Greenspan got lucky. Maybe Bernanke got lucky. Maybe Yellen and Powell are going to get lucky. But one of the things that you've pointed out is that, in fact, we've had manias and busts, two so far and a third in the offing in one generation. And this really is not a success story. This is saying that something is happening here that's never happened before. And we're playing with perceptions of success and beliefs, maybe because we want to believe that they were successful, when in fact, like William White, that's not really how the record should be recorded, because this series of booms and busts is uncommon in history. So I wonder if maybe you can dive in on that a little bit. This is really not as much a success story as we're led to believe, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, did you say central bankers were artists rather than scientists?
That's what William White claimed.
Is that the word you use? Artist?
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I've never heard that. That is brilliant. That's wonderful. Yes, they're not scientists. They call economics the dismal science. It is indeed the dismal science. If you're a good economist, you are probably an artist. I love that. Now, Greenspan was lucky, and he knows it because he has said it recently. He has probably felt that way since the NASDAQ crashed in 2000. It's the same thing here. They're all blindly guessing at what's to come. And in the interim, we're seeing situations we've never had before, like the aforementioned $21 trillion in debt. So, yeah, they're bound to be artists, and that's no way to run an economy.
So let's go in sort of a thought experiment, use our imagination, to post-third mania, the collapse after this third mania, which is, you know, arguably fourth quarter this last year. We got to see sort of the revelation of cracks within the financial system, and perhaps we see more of that here in 2019 and in 2020. I'm concerned about what the consequences are for capitalism, for capital formation, for investment. What do you think the long-term consequences are to capital formation and investment on the other side of this third mania?
Eventually, things will be all right. I mean, when stocks return to a level where you can find excellent values, you're not going to avoid the market. You're going to buy stocks. So eventually, it all comes together. I'm not sure exactly how far down the road, but this is the way markets work. You have bull markets, then you have bear markets. You're not supposed to have a mania followed by a bear, and a mania followed by another bear, and then a mania followed by another bear, all with, just for the sake of argument, 50% declines in prices. But we did recover from stock prices going down 50% in 2003. We did recover from stock prices going down in 2009, and I think we'll eventually recover if the market goes down 50% from here again. But every time we do something like that, we just make it very difficult for the generation behind ours. We've already mortgaged part of the next generation's lives with the tremendous debt we've built up. But I think eventually, at some point, it's all going to come up smelling like roses. But we may be down to Dow 15,000 before that happens, or worse.
I want to come back to a couple questions about, again, CAPE and Shiller PE in just a minute. But I am curious what you think about politics and public policy, how they fit into the narrative of boom and bust. And do you see anything developing in the months and years ahead, kind of as a reaction to the third mania and bust? Yeah, some talk about banning corporate buybacks. And, you know, I'm curious your thoughts, the public policy response.
Well, you mentioned corporate buybacks, and I'm a firm believer that corporate buybacks exist for executives at these corporations. Anybody who has a stock option plan, if the company is buying back their stock, they're supporting the price of the stock. So your options are worth more money. As far as politics, how that enters, I'm not particularly a fan of either Republican or Democratic politics. I think they're at odds with one another. I think we go nowhere in the interim, except the level of debt keeps on rising. So that's the big negative. And how does that change? I don't know. I'm not that smart. But I don't think politics helps.
Well, we've got actually in cumulative values, corporate buybacks have now exceeded what the central bank has put in terms of quantitative easing from the 2008 to present period here in the United States.
Amazing,
right?
We're
talking about massive sums of money. And I think you're right. It is an executive gaming type thing. Well, so you mentioned debt, and the debt keeps on rising. This is an area that you're concerned about. Maybe you can comment on these record levels, U.S. national debt, corporate debt, household debt. Household debt's at a new all-time high. I mean, does it ever get boring to you saying that over and over again? A new all-time high, margin debt, a new all-time high, household debt, a new all-time. At some point, it does matter. But when and how and what the tipping point is, maybe we don't know. How do you wrap your mind around the trillions upon trillions upon trillions as it relates to economic growth in the future when we have all this debt to service?
You make a very good point. You know, we can be just somewhat ignorant because we keep on seeing these numbers go up and we don't know how to parse them. for instance, student debt. Just a few years ago, I kept on hearing the $1 trillion mark bandied about. Well, now it's $1.5 trillion. And this is not a small segment of our society. This is 44 million Americans that owe this much money. How does it get paid off? Well, you know how the margin debt gets paid off. It gets paid off with lower stock prices. That's not a good thing. Lower stock prices means Americans have less assets, means they have less wealth. That means they can buy less stuff. Well, it's the same thing with the students. How do you pay off $1.5 trillion in student debt? Now, my wife, she was born in Havana, Cuba. She was on a Cuban loan when she was in college. And she paid it off very simply by teaching for 7 years in the New York school systems. But she had, I don't know how many thousands. It wasn't that bad. But when you're talking about students with $100,000 in debt or much more, my wife and I were very fortunate. Our youngest, who has a law degree, at 7 years of school, we paid out of pocket $185,000. Out of pocket. He had $162,000 in scholarships. So if he didn't have the scholarships to put him through, for him to become an attorney, we're talking close to $350,000? How do people do that? I honestly don't know. And this is one of the reasons why a lot of people fear we're falling behind, whereas other countries are catching up to us. I'm not sure this has answered your question. I think I went off on a little bit of a tangent. I apologize.
No. This all relates. I think the point you were making earlier about the cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio, the Shiller PE as it's popularly referred to, you mentioned it's pretty high, second highest in history. Give us a little education here. In terms of the swings from overvaluation and back to undervaluation, once you get to that level of undervaluation, it suggests something about what you can earn on an annual return basis. What is the current level being overvalued? What does that suggest about the direction of the Dow and the potential depth of pricing for the Dow within a bear market?
Well, until we had the tech mania, the highest this ratio ever went was Black Tuesday in 1929. It was at 30. Well, it's at 30 today. It's actually at 30.02. It was as high as nearly 45 in the tech mania, but I don't think we'll see that again in our lifetimes, not even your children's lifetime. No way. The mean and the median are way below. The mean is 16.6. The median is 15.7. Again, we're at 30. So you're talking about a 50% hit in prices before we get to the mean or the median. And as far as the minimum, in 1920, it was down to under 5. I don't think you'll ever see that again, but you could certainly see this indicator, which has a lot of validity over the long term, fall to, let's say, 16. That means prices are down almost 50%. Uncannily, this kind of fits my long-term bear market target, which I came up with probably 5 years ago. That's 14,719 for the Dow. We should all write that down. I think I'm going to get a hit on that one. I really do. I don't know when.
So 14,719 is your long-term bear market target. What's the difference between what you call the long-term market target and a crash, what you categorize as crash risk?
I think we have crash risk right now down to a little above 17,000 on the Dow. They are two different numbers. A long-term bear market target, that includes the period where you have a crash, if we have a crash, and then there's this long period of disinvestment because people are just, even professionals, are shattered. So stocks go down some more in price, and that's where I think the bottom is, a little bit below 15,000. But if you have a period like we had earlier in the year, but much more emphatic, that could result in prices going down about 8,000 points. I've seen crashes before.
There's a number of people on Wall Street that aren't exactly prepared for that, either in portfolio position or in probably psychological constitution.
It's impossible to prepare for that data. It's impossible.
There's this change in dynamic amongst investors, speculators. Maybe we already hit on it where we were talking about high-frequency traders and algorithmic trading. But why do you think holding periods for stocks were so long in the early 1920s and then actually began to decrease, where they were low by the time you got to the market mania. And then you saw this increase, the significant increase in terms of the time people would buy a stock and hold a stock that continued to grow all through the 1960s. Now again, we're at the comparable levels to the late 1920s, where nobody wants to hold things beyond a nanosecond. At what point would you say that we've transformed from being investors, and that's the playground we're in, to really being in a speculator's arena?
That started in 1998, when the tech mania really started to take hold. Ironically, what's going to happen some years down the road after the mania burst is that holding periods are going to go up, but for a number of reasons. It's not only that people will be seeking value and they will understand that they have to hold on to stocks for a longer period of time to realize that value, but it has also to do with the fact they got so savaged in the fallout. I'll give you a little story, a little illustration of how this works. My father was a stockbroker in 1929. He took everything he had after the crash and he threw into the safe deposit box. And in this is what really got me started on stocks. 1964, he had me take everything out of the safe deposit box and jot down what it was on a piece of paper. And I went to the Brooklyn Business Library every day for 6 months. Yes, he had a lot of stock. He had a lot of worthless stock. But he had a few things that were worth money. Just for the sake of argument, he had lawyer's title, guarantee, and trust that he bought for about $400 a share that was valueless. He had shares of manufacturers Hanover Trust. Do you know that name?
Sure. That's a
long time ago. Okay. He had a spinoff from manufacturers Hanover. He had a decent position. The company was called Euron Holding and was only worth $37 total. All right. Here's the rub. He had Chase National stock. That's the forerunner of Chase Manhattan and J.P. Morgan Chase. And on the back of the certificate, it said, attached share for share is Amerex Corp, A-M-E-R-E-X. And he was getting letters from asset tracers for years telling him, Mr. Newman, you have some money here you don't know about. If you give us 50%, we'll tell you what it is. So he was too smart for that. He had me do the dirty work. So it turns out that the shares of Amerex he had, which was a forerunner of American Express, were worth $20,000 and had $4,000 in accrued dividend. But understand, that stock had been held onto from 1929. So that's a long holding period, from 1929 to 1964, 35 years. So eventually you'll have that situation again where the holding periods will go up, not only because there'll be valuations there that can only be realized if you sit on it and let it grow and watch it grow, but because people got savaged in the market before and they don't even want to look at the stock certificate. They don't even want to look at their statement.
Well, I mean, this is what you were describing earlier, talking about professionals being shattered.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad was a professional who psychologically said, I'm putting it in a safety deposit box, 1929, and doesn't want to look at it, doesn't care, can't be brought back into that emotional state for 35 years. In fact, he has you do it for him.
Precisely.
Well, it reminds me of something else, Alan. There's something, I had a conversation with a gentleman that runs a significant family office in the Southeast, multi-billion-dollar family office, and they are in the process of moving out of exchange-traded funds, any exposure whatsoever, and they've been, over the last year or so, positioning very considerable amounts of money in cash with the idea that they will, on an intergenerational basis, be sitting on quality companies, very researched, as you suggested, from the kind of the Graham and Dodd model.
Right.
Focused on value, as in when price reveals that value, they're going to be happy to sit on it and hold individual shares again. And it's such a different trend than you hear from the small-time investor who's very interested in maximizing the last 20 basis points. And actually, this family is willing to say, that's fine. We don't want to pay the fee implicit to an ETF, whether it's a Vanguard inexpensive fee or something that's more grandiose. We want to own the companies themselves. And we're willing to wait. We don't want professional money management. We just want quality forever. I think we're getting to the point where they're going to have their wish.
I think that works.
Well, what kind of volatility? If I mean, we've been talking about the third mania. We've been talking about the consequences of that in terms of how it breaks apart over time and how professionals, those of whom who today haven't experienced much pain, experience something of a shattering of expectations. What kind of volatility do you expect in the coming months? Maybe you have to expand that out to years, but on the horizon, talk to us about volatility.
I don't think we saw very much in the last year's late decline around 36 level, but in the beginning of the year,
VIX.
When we had that decline in February, it was up around 50. I'm talking about the volatility yep. index. I think we're going to see higher than 50. I mean, if I'm right at all about this bear market target, we're going to have a huge decline in a very short period of time at some point, and it's going to take volatility measures up way past where they were a year ago, and certainly way, way past where they were at the end of last year. This move late last year, I think, was pretty tame by historical standards. Moreover, the most important consideration I'm looking at in terms of volatility and assurance that that cycle will be upon us at some point is that we've seen no instances, zero, of capitulation on a daily basis on NASDAQ. Not one. Even as far as NASDAQ fell recently in the correction, there was not one day. I measure capitulation as 1 to 9 up to down volume. That's significant. 1 share up, 9 shares down. In other words, 90% of volume is to the downside. We have not had one instance like that on NASDAQ actually in, I think it's about 450 trading sessions. I can't begin to tell you how unusual that is. I've never seen a period that tame for NASDAQ.
So if volatility is on the increase, and your operative word there was capitulation, it was lacking. I want to go back to 2008, 2009. Was that a tradable low, or was that, do we actually see capitulation then in terms of investor sentiment? Or was it simply a tradable low in the context of a longer-term structural bear market?
No, I think there was capitulation. And one of the reasons why was it was almost the end of the world. I mean, the way we were looking at markets and banks and brokerage companies, it sure looked like the end of the world was not that far away. But again, we've seen worse than that, too. VIX got up to 81 then, but in the crash, it was 172. What I'm frightened about is, I'm old enough to understand that anything can happen. I have a couple of buddies. One of them, a high school classmate, he trades naked options. I would never, in my wildest dream, trade even one naked option. I mean, it's not the type of person I am, but that's the type of situation where you get up and go to the restroom and you come back and you have very, very big problems. And I do think that's going to happen at some point, too, where the speed of market moves is just going to be almost incomprehensible.
So capitulation in the 2000, let's say 19, expanded out to 2023. We don't know what the future holds. We don't know what the time frame is. Does capitulation look any different in this period of time, central bank interventions, things like that? Does it look any different this time around than, say, it would have 2008, 2009, or 1929, talking about a VIX spike, a pretty significant loss in capital, real sense of fear, foreboding, as you said, the end of the world.
Yeah.
Is it any different this time, or are these the things that you look for?
I'm not sure, but I will say I don't think it's going to look different, and the reason why I say that is what central banks did after the tech mania imploded worked. I mean, it got us to 2007. Prices were up substantially. It worked again in 2009. I mean, they actually saved us from the worst possible fate. I mean, with banks going down, with brokerages going down, we were literally very close to the precipice. And I see no reason why it's not going to work this time. I'm not saying that the results are going to be wonderful for us. I'm saying they're going to do the same thing they've done twice before.
That argues for some version of creativity. Again, we're back to the artist's palette, QE being an expression of that. Maybe there's more extraordinary things that our imaginations can't latch onto quite yet in terms of monetary policy creativity. But more QE, Which brings us full circle to what are the things that you want to own in a period of time where central bankers are desperate to maintain credibility and maintain asset price stability? Is it some combination of real assets and cash, keeping high liquidity and making sure that's offset with something that's tangible? What's the best strategy on a 3-year, 5-year basis?
Well, if you're going out a little further than a 3 to 5 year, because that's what we were talking about before, if central banks were gold investors, maybe that would be the difference for the next cycle, but I don't see how that works. But I'm not concerned about that. As a private investor, my insurance policy is gold. I favor stocks over bullion, but that's just me. I'm maybe crazy that way, but I love stocks. I've loved stocks since I'm 1964. That's what I excel at. So I try and find values there. And if I'm right about gold taking preeminence at some point, when we have this Dow to gold ratio of 5-to-1, these gold stocks are going to do quite well. So that's where I'm at, basically. I have to have that insurance policy.
That complements your other real assets, real estate, which you say a clear benefit having a cash flow component, which bullion does not. And, you know, you make a good case for gold stocks. Many of them do, in fact, have dividend policies that pay out a significant portion of profits, if and when they ever have profits. On those rare occasions, they do have healthy policies there for investors that are interested in income.
Yes, they do.
Alan, we've had you on the program every year for, I think, at least the last 5 or 6 years, and we love reading Cross Currents and are always excited about the next issue, and now we have to await with bated breath the next issue, if it is going to be released. And we're on a need-to-know basis.
You're too kind.
You'll let us know if it's coming in. Thank you for your contribution, 30-plus years, 55 years as an investor, and we're excited to have you back on the program at some point, if it's not too much of an intrusion into your life there in Florida and in your personal affairs. We always appreciate your opinions.
And thank you very much for inviting me on again. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, David.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Alan Newman. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.